Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. I also post links at pieville.net, our social medium for antisocial people who don't like the garbage you find on most social media and do like being uncensored in what they say. I also post links at kirksvilletoday.com where I do a daily white world wrap, exploring the world from a white perspective, finding out what's good and bad in relation thereto. Today we're going to resume with Saki, Hector Human Row, The Complete Stories of Saki, and do four more stories. It's about the ordinary length, and it begins with Clovis, our old hero, on parental responsibilities. And if you're like me, you should be, if not giddy, at least filled with anticipation. Clovis on Parental Responsibilities. Marion Eggleby sat talking to Clovis on the only subject that she ever willingly talked about, her offspring and their varied perfections and accomplishments. Clovis was not in what could be called a receptive mood. The younger generation of Eggleby, depicted in the glowing improbable colors of parent impressionism, aroused in him no enthusiasm. Mrs. Eggleby, on the other hand, was furnished with enthusiasm enough for two. "Oh, you would like Eric," she said argumentatively rather than hopefully. Clovis had intimated very unmistakably that he was unlikely to care extravagantly for either Amy or Willie. "Yes, I feel sure that you would like Eric. Everyone takes to him at once. You know, he always reminds me of that famous picture of the youthful David. I forget who it's by, but it's very well known." "That would be sufficient to set me against him if I saw much of him," said Clovis. "Just imagine at Auction Bridge, for instance, when one was trying to concentrate one's mind on what one's partner's original declaration had been, and to remember what suits one's opponents had originally discarded, what it would be like to have someone persistently reminding one of a picture of the youthful David. It would be simply maddening. If Eric did that, I should detest him. I always have in mind the David Hyde Pierce character from Frasier, the Niles Crane, the younger, tiny little brother. Very, very similar. I almost wonder if the writer there didn't model off Clovis to an extent. Obviously, Niles, Frasier, and Cheers, Frasier was older, but there's a pretty similar verbal approach. Just as a general part about art and how artists use and borrow and amend and amend and emend, make critical alterations to or draw inspiration from others. That would be, okay, so Eric doesn't play bridge, said Mrs. Eggleby with dignity. Doesn't he? Asked Clovis. Why not? None of my children have been brought up to play card games, said Mrs. Eggleby. Drafts and Halma and these sorts of games I encourage. Eric is considered quite a wonderful drafts player. Draughts, I don't know if it's drafts, I think. You are strewing dreadful risks in the path of your family, said Clovis. A friend of mine who is a prison chaplain told me that among the worst criminal cases that have come under his notice, men condemned to death or to long periods of penal servitude, there was not a single bridge player. On the other hand, he knew at least two expert drafts players among them. I really don't see what my boys have got to do with the criminal classes, said Mrs. Eggleby resentfully. They have been most carefully brought up, I can assure you of that. That shows that you were nervous as to how they would turn out, said Clovis. Now, my mother never bothered about bringing me up. She just saw to it that I got whacked at decent intervals and was taught the difference between right and wrong. There is some difference, you know, but I've forgotten what it is. Forgotten the difference between right and wrong? Exclaimed Mrs. Eggleby. Well, you see, I took up natural history and a whole lot of other subjects at the same time, and one can't remember everything, can one? I used to know the difference between the Sardinian dormouse and the ordinary kind, and whether the wryneck arrives at our shores earlier than the cuckoo, or the other way around, and how long the walrus takes in growing to maturity. I dare say you knew all these sort of things once, but I bet you've forgotten them. Those things are not important, said Miss Eggleby, but the fact that we've both forgotten them proves that they are important, said Clovis. You must have noticed that it's always the important things that one forgets while the trivial, unnecessary facts of life stick in one's memory. Again, very Oscar Wilde. There's my cousin, Editha Clubberly, for instance. I can never forget that her birthday is on the 12th of October. It's a matter of utter indifference to me on what day her birthday falls, or whether she was born at all. Either fact seems to me absolutely trivial or unnecessary. I've heaps of other cousins to go on with. On the other hand, when I'm staying with Hildegard Shrubley, I can never remember the important circumstance, whether her first husband got his unenviable reputation on the turf or the stock exchange. And that uncertainty rules sport and finance out of the conversation at once. One can never mention travel either, because her second husband had to live permanently abroad. Mrs. Shrubley and I move in very different circles, said Mrs. Eggleby stiffly. No one who knows Hildegard could possibly accuse her of moving in a circle, said Clovis. Her view of life seems to be a non-stop run with an inexhaustible supply of petrol. If she can get someone else to pay for the petrol, so much the better. I don't mind confessing to you that she has taught me more than any other woman I can think of. What kind of knowledge? Demanded Mrs. Eggleby, with the air a jury might collectively wear when finding a verdict without leaving the box. Well, among other things, she's introduced me to at least 4 different ways of cooking lobster, said Clovis gratefully. That, of course, wouldn't appeal to you. People who abstain from the pleasures of the card table never really appreciate the finer possibilities of the dining table. I suppose their powers of enlightened enjoyment get atrophied from disuse. An aunt of mine was very ill after eating a lobster, said Mrs. Eggleby. I dare say if we knew more of her history, we should find out that she'd often been ill before eating the lobster. Aren't you concealing the fact that she'd had measles and influenza and nervous headache and hysteria and other things that aunts do have long before she ate the lobster? Aunts that have never known a day's illness are very rare. In fact, I don't personally know any. Of course, if she ate it as a child of 2 weeks old, it might have been her first illness and her last, but if that was the case, I think you should have said so. I must be going, said Mrs. Eggleby in a tone which had been thoroughly sterilized of even perfunctory regret. Clovis rose with an air of graceful reluctance. I have so enjoyed our little talk about Eric, he said. I quite look forward to meeting him someday. Goodbye, said Mrs. Eggleby frostily. The supplementary remark which she made at the back of her throat was, I'll take care that you never shall. That was Clovis on parental responsibility. Next up, we've got a holiday task. Kenelm Jurton. Pretty typical, goofy name that he gives the character. Kenelm, one word, Jurton, entered the dining hall of the Golden Galleon Hotel in the full crush of the luncheon hour. Nearly every seat was occupied, and small additional tables had been brought in where floor space permitted to accommodate latecomers, with the result that many of the tables were almost touching each other. Jurton was beckoned by a waiter to the only vacant table that was discernible and took his seat with the uncomfortable and wholly groundless idea that everyone in the room was staring at him. In a holiday task. He was a youngish man of ordinary appearance, quiet of dress, and unobtrusive of manner, and he never could wholly rid himself of the idea that a fierce light of public scrutiny beat on him as though he had been a notability or a supernut. After he had ordered lunch, there came the unavoidable interval of waiting, with nothing to do but stare at the flower vase on the table and to be stared at in imagination by several flappers. So flappers were a thing even before 1920. Some mature beings of the same sex and a satirical-looking Jew. In order to carry off the situation with some appearance of unconcern, he became spuriously interested in the contents of the flower vase. What is the name of those roses, do you know? He asked the waiter. The waiter was ready at all times to conceal his ignorance concerning items of the wine list or menu. He was frankly ignorant as to the specific name of the roses. Amy Sylvester Partington, said a voice at Jurton's elbow. The voice came from a pleasant-faced, well-dressed young woman who was sitting at a table that almost touched Jurton's. He thanked her hurriedly and nervously for the information, and made some inconsequent remark about the flowers. "It is a curious thing," said the young woman, "that I should be able to tell you the name of those roses without an effort of memory, because if you were to ask me my name, I should be utterly unable to give it to you." Jerton had not harbored the least intention of extending his thirst for name labels to his neighbor. After her rather remarkable announcement, however, he was obliged to say something in the way of polite inquiry. "Yes," answered the lady, "I suppose it is a case of partial loss of memory. I was in the train coming down here. My ticket told me that I had come from Victoria and was bound for this place. I had a couple of 5-pound notes and a sovereign on me, no visiting cards or any other means of identification, and no idea as to who I am. I can only hazily recollect that I have a title. I am Lady Somebody. Beyond that, my mind is a blank." "Hadn't you any luggage with you?" asked Jerton. "That is what I didn't know. I knew the name of the hotel and made up my mind to come here. And when the hotel porter who meets the trains asked if I had any luggage, I had to invent a dressing bag and a dress basket. I could always pretend that they had gone astray. I gave him the name of Smith, and presently he emerged from a confused pile of luggage and passengers with a dressing bag and dress basket labeled Kestrel Smith. I had to take them. I don't see what else I could have done." Jerton said nothing, but he rather wondered what the lawful owner of the baggage would do. Of course, it was dreadful arriving at a strange hotel with the name of Kestrel Smith, but it would have been worse to have arrived without luggage. Anyhow, I hate causing trouble. Jerton had visions of harassed railway officials and distraught Kestrel Smiths, but he made no attempt to clothe his mental picture in words. The lady continued her story. "Naturally, none of my keys would fit the things, but I told an intelligent page boy that I had lost my key ring, and he had the locks forced in a twinkling." "Rather too intelligent, that boy. He will probably end up in Dartmoor, which I guess is a prison. Or G-A-O-L, jail, as they say. The Kestrel Smith toilet tools aren't up to much, but they are better than nothing." "If you feel sure that you have a title," said Jerton, "why not get hold of a peerage and go right through it?" "I tried that. I skimmed through the list of the House of Lords and Whitaker, but a mere printed string of names conveys awfully little to one, you know. If you were an army officer and had lost your identity, you might pore over the army list for months without finding out who you were. I'm going on another tack. I'm trying to find out by various little tests who I am not. That will narrow the range of uncertainty down a bit. You may have noticed, for instance, that I'm lunching principally off Lobster Newburgh." Jerton had not ventured to notice anything of the sort. "It's an extravagance, because it's one of the most expensive dishes on the menu, but at any rate it proves that I'm not Lady Starping. She never touches shellfish. And poor Lady Brattleshrub has no digestion at all. If I am her, I shall certainly die in agony in the course of the afternoon, and the duty of finding out who I am will devolve on the press and the police and those sort of people. I shall be past caring. Lady Newfer doesn't know one rose from another, and she hates men, so she wouldn't have spoken to you in any case, and Lady Mousehilton flirts with every man she meets. I haven't flirted with you, have I?" Jerton hastily gave the required assurance. "Well, you see," continued the lady, "that knocks 4 off the list at once. It'll be rather a lengthy process bringing the list down to 1, said Jerton. "Oh, but of course there are heaps of them that I couldn't possibly be. Women who've got grandchildren or sons old enough to have celebrated their coming of age. I've only got to consider the ones about my own age. I tell you how you might help me this afternoon, if you don't mind. Go through any of the back numbers of Country Life, it's a magazine, and those sort of papers that you can find in the smoking room, and see if you come across my portrait with infant son or anything of that sort. It won't take you 10 minutes. I'll meet you in the lounge about tea time. Thanks awfully." And the fair unknown, capital F and U, having graciously pressed Jerton into the search for her lost identity, rose and left the room. As she passed the young man's table, she halted for a moment and whispered, "Did you notice that I tipped the waiter a shilling? We can cross Lady Ulwhite off the list. She would have died rather than do that." At 5 o'clock, Jerton made his way to the hotel lounge. He had spent a diligent but fruitless quarter of an hour among the illustrated weeklies in the smoking room. His new acquaintance was seated at a small tea table with a waiter hovering in attendance. "China tea or Indian?" she asked as Jerton came up. "China, please, and nothing to eat. Have you discovered anything?" Only negative information. I'm not Lady Befnal. She disapproves dreadfully at any form of gambling, so when I recognized a well-known bookmaker in the hotel lobby, I went and put a tenner on an unnamed filly by William III out of Mitrovica for the 3:15 race. I suppose the fact of the animal being nameless was what attracted me.
Did it win? Asked Jordan.
No, it came in fourth, the most irritating thing a horse can do when you've hacked it to win or place.
Come in first or second.
Anyhow, I know now that I'm not Lady Befnal.
It seems to me that the knowledge was rather dearly bought, said Jordan.
Well, yes, it rather cleared me out, admitted the identity seeker. A florin is about all I've got left in me. The lobster Newberg made my lunch rather an expensive one, and of course I had to tip the boy for what he did to that Kestrel Smithlocks. I've got a rather useful idea, though. I feel certain that I belong to the Pivot Club. I'll go back to town and ask the hall porter there if there are any letters for me. He knows all the members by sight, and if there are any letters or telephone messages waiting for me, of course that will solve the problem. If he says there aren't any, I shall say, you know who I am, don't you? So I'll find out anyway. The plan seemed a sound one. A difficulty in its execution suggested itself to Jordan.
Of course, said the lady when he hinted at the obstacle, there's my fare back to town and my bill here in cabs and things. If you lend me £3, that ought to see me through comfortably. Thanks ever so. Then there is the question of that luggage. I don't want to be saddled with that for the rest of my life. I'll have it brought down to the hall, and you can pretend to mount guard over it while I'm writing a letter. Then I shall just slip away to the station, and you can wander off to the smoking room, and they can do what they like with the things. They'll advertise themselves after a bit, and the owner can claim them.
Jordan acquiesced in the maneuver and duly mounted guard over the luggage while its temporary owner slipped unobtrusively out of the hotel. Her departure was not, however, altogether unnoticed. Two gentlemen were strolling past Jordan, and one of them remarked to the other, "Did you see that tall young woman in gray who went out just now? She is the lady." His promenade carried him out of the earshot at the critical moment when he was about to disclose the elusive identity. The lady who? Jordan could scarcely run after a total stranger, break into his conversation, and ask him for information concerning a chance passerby. Besides, it was desirable that he should keep up the appearance of looking after the luggage. In a minute or two, however, the important personage, the man who knew, came strolling back alone. Jordan summoned up all his courage and waylaid him.
I think I heard you say that you knew the lady who went out of the hotel a few minutes ago, a tall lady dressed in gray. Excuse me for asking if you could tell me her name. I've been talking to her for half an hour. She knows all my people, and she seems to know me, so I suppose I've met her somewhere before. But I'm blessed if I can put a name to her. Could you?
Well, certainly. She's a Mrs. Stroop.
Mrs.? Queried Jordan.
Yes, yeah, she's the lady champion at golf in my part of the world, an awful good sort. And goes about a good deal in society, but she has an awkward habit of losing her memory every now and then and gets into all sorts of fixes. She's furious, too, if you make any allusion to it afterwards.
Good day, sir.
The stranger passed on his way, and before Jordan had time to assimilate his information, he found his whole attention centered on an angry-looking lady who was making loud and fretful-seeming inquiries of the hotel clerks.
Has any luggage been brought here from the station by mistake? A dress basket and dressing case with the name Kestrel Smith. It can't be traced anywhere. I saw it put in at Victoria, that I'll swear.
Why, there's my luggage, and the locks have been tampered with.
Jordan heard no more. He fled down to the Turkish bath and stayed there for hours.
Now, if I might editorialize for a minute. I don't understand why you would write a story that's really not about very much. Maybe to you that was about a lot. I don't know. I find some of these kind of slices that are a little bit weird. The conception kind of... And it probably is me that can't see entirely what he's going for other than a brief scene in the life of this shy young man, I suppose. Next up, the stalled ox. Theophil Eshley was an artist by profession, a cattle painter by force of environment. It is not to be supposed that he lived on a ranch or a dairy farm in an atmosphere pervaded with horn and hoof, milking stool, and branding iron. His home was in a park-like villa
villa-dotted district that only just escaped the reproach of being suburban. On one side of his garden, there abutted a small picturesque meadow in which an enterprising neighbor pastured some small picturesque cows of the Channel Island persuasion. At noonday in summertime, the cows stood knee-deep in tall meadow grass under the shade of a group of walnut trees, with the sunlight falling in dappled patches on their mouse-sleek coats. Eshley had conceived and executed a dainty picture of two reposeful milch cows in a setting of walnut tree and meadow grass and filtered sunbeam, and the Royal Academy had duly exposed the same on the walls of its summer exhibition. The Royal Academy encourages orderly, methodical habits in its children. Eshley had painted if they succeed once, they're going to keep doing the same thing that got them the success. Eshley had painted a successful and acceptable picture of cattle drowsing picturesquely under walnut trees, and as he had begun, so of necessity he went on. His noontide piece, a study of two dun cows, dun sort of plain tan cows under a walnut tree, was followed by a midday sanctuary, a study of a walnut tree with two dun cows under it. So all these pictures of two cows in a walnut tree. In due succession there came Where the Gadflies Cease from Troubling, The Haven of the Herd, and A Dream in Dairyland, studies of walnut trees and dun cows. His two attempts to break away from his own tradition were signal failures. Turtle doves alarmed by sparrowhawk, and wolves on the Roman Campagna, that means countryside in Italian, came back to his studio in the guise of abominable heresies, and Eshley climbed back into grace and the public gaze with A Shaded Nook Where Drowsy Milkers Dream. So he starts as an artist, but then becomes a cover band of himself. Even his original stuff is just fakes the original, and he's not evolving and developing. On a fine afternoon in late autumn, he was putting some finishing touches to a study of meadow weeds when his neighbor, Adela Pingsford, assailed the outer door of his studio with a loud, peremptory knockings. "There is an ox in my garden," she announced, in explanation of the tempestuous intrusion. "An ox," said Eshley blankly, rather fatuously. "What kind of an ox?" "Oh, I don't know what kind," snapped the lady. "A common or garden ox, to use the slang expression. It is the garden part of it that I object to. My garden has just been put straight for the winter, and an ox roaming about it won't improve matters. Besides, there are the chrysanthemums just coming into flower." "How did it get into the garden?" asked Eshley. "I imagine it came in by the gate," said the lady impatiently. "It couldn't have climbed the walls, and I don't suppose anyone dropped it from an aeroplane as a Bovril advertisement. The immediately important question is not how it got in, but how to get it out." "Won't it go?" said Eshley. "If it was anxious to go," said Adela Pingsford rather angrily, "I should not have come here to chat with you about it. I'm practically all alone. The housemaid is having her afternoon out. The cook is lying down with an attack of neuralgia. Anything that I may have learned in school or in life after about how to remove a large ox from a small garden seems to have escaped from my memory now. All I could think of was that you were a near neighbor and a cattle painter, presumably more or less familiar with the subjects that you painted, and that you might be of some slight assistance. Possibly I was mistaken." "I paint dairy cows, certainly," admitted Eshley, "but I cannot claim to have had any experience in rounding up stray oxen. I've seen it done on cinema film, of course, but there were always horses and lots of other accessories. Besides, one never knows how much of those pictures are faked." Adela Pingsford said nothing, but led the way to her garden. It was normally a fair-sized garden, but it looked small in comparison with the ox, a huge, mottled brute, dull red about the head and shoulders, passing to dirty white on the flanks and hindquarters, with shaggy ears and large, bloodshot eyes. It bore about as much resemblance to the dainty paddock heifers that Eshley was accustomed to paint, as the chief of a Kurdish nomad clan would to a Japanese tea shop girl. Eshley stood very near the gate while he studied the animal's appearance and demeanor. Adela Pingsford continued to say nothing. "It's eating a chrysanthemum," said Eshley at last, when the silence had become unbearable. How observant you are, said Adela. God damn these names. He's had two or three of these that I just don't know how to pronounce. Adela. How observant you are, said Adela bitterly. You seem to notice everything. As a matter of fact, it has got six chrysanthemums in its mouth at the present moment. The necessity for doing something was becoming imperative. Ashley took a step or two in the direction of the animal, clapped his hands, and made noises of the hish and shoo variety. If the ox heard them, it gave no outward indication of the fact. If any hen should ever stray into my garden, said Adela, I should certainly send for you to frighten them away. You shoo beautifully. Meanwhile, do you mind trying to drive the ox away? That is a Mademoiselle Louis Bichot that he's begun on now, she added in an icy calm, as a glowing orange head was crushed into the huge, munching mouth. Since you have been so frank about the variety of the chrysanthemum, said Ashley, I don't mind telling you that this is an Ayrshire ox. The icy calm broke down. Adela Pinksford used language that sent the artist instinctively a few feet nearer to the ox. He picked up a pea stick and flung it with some determination against the animal's mottled flanks. The operation of mashing Mademoiselle Louise Bichot into a petal salad was suspended for a long moment while the ox gazed with concentrated inquiry at the stick thrower. Adela gazed with equal concentration and more obvious hostility at the same focus. As the beast neither lowered its head nor stamped its feet, Ashley ventured on another javelin exercise with another pea stick. The ox seemed to realize at once that it was to go. It gave a hurried final pluck at the bed where the chrysanthemums had been and strode swiftly up the garden. Ashley ran to head it towards the gate, but only succeeded in quickening its pace from a walk to a lumbering trot. With an air of inquiry, but with no real hesitation, it crossed a tiny strip of turf that the charitable called the croquet lawn and pushed its way through the open French window into the morning room. Some chrysanthemums and other autumn herbage stood about in the room in vases, and the animal resumed its browsing operations. All the same, Ashley fancied that the beginnings of a hunted look had come into its eyes, a look that counseled respect. He discontinued his attempt to interfere with its choice of surroundings. Mr. Ashley, said Adela in a shaking voice, I asked you to drive that beast out of my garden, but I did not ask you to drive it into my house. If I must have it anywhere in the premises, I prefer the garden to the morning room. Well, cattle drives are not in my line, said Ashley. If I remember, I told you so at the outset. I quite agree, retorted the lady. Painting pretty pictures of pretty little cows is what you're suited for. Perhaps you'd like to do a nice sketch of that ox making itself at home in my morning room. This time it seemed as if the worm had turned. Ashley began striding away. Where are you going? Screamed Adela. To fetch implements, was the answer. Implements? I won't have you use a lasso. The room will be wrecked if there's a struggle. But the artist marched out of the garden. In a couple of minutes he returned, laden with easel, sketching stool, and painting materials. Do you mean to say that you're going to sit quietly down and paint that brute while it's destroying my morning room? Gasped Adela. It was your suggestion, said Ashley, setting his canvas in position. I forbid it. I absolutely forbid it, stormed Adela. I don't see what standing you have in the matter. You can hardly pretend that it's your ox, even by adoption. You seem to forget that it's my morning room, eating my flowers, came the raging retort. You seem to forget that the cook has neuralgia, said Ashley. She may be just dozing off and into a merciful sleep, and your outcry will awaken her. Consideration for others should be the guiding principle of people in our station of life. The man is mad, exclaimed Adela tragically. A moment later, it was Adela herself who appeared to go mad. The ox had finished the vase flowers and the cover of Israel Kalish, and appeared to be thinking of leaving its rather restricted quarters. Ashley noticed its restlessness and promptly flung at some bunches of Virginia creeper leaves as an inducement to continue the sitting. I forget how the proverb runs, he observed, something about better is a dinner of herbs than a stalled ox where hate is. We seem to have all the ingredients for the proverb ready to hand. I shall go to the public library and get them to telephone for the police, announced Adela. And, raging audibly, she departed. Some minutes later, the ox, awakening probably to the suspicion that oil cake and chopped mangold was waiting for it in some appointed byre, stepped with much precaution out of the morning room, stared with grave inquiry at the no longer obtrusive and pea-stick-throwing human, and then lumbered heavily but swiftly out of the garden. Eshley packed up his tools and followed the animal's example, and Larkdean was left in neuralgia and the cook. The episode was the turning point in Eshley's artistic career. His remarkable picture, Ox in a Morning Room, Late Autumn, was one of the sensations and successes of the next Paris Salon, and when it was subsequently exhibited at Munich, it was bought by the Bavarian government in the teeth of the spirited bidding of the three meat extract firms. Of three meat extract firms, and the Bavarian government bid over it. From that moment, his success was continuous and assured, and the Royal Academy was thankful, 2 years later, to give a conspicuous position on its walls to his large canvas, Barbary Apes Wrecking a Boudoir. Eshley presented Adela Pinksford with a new copy of Israel Kalish and a couple of finely flowering plants of Madame André Blousset, but nothing in the nature of a real reconciliation has taken place between them. That was a pretty good one, I would say. And now the last one of this quartet, which will be The Storyteller. The Storyteller, hyphenated. It was a hot afternoon, and the railway carriage was correspondingly sultry. This was written for air conditioning, of course. And the next stop was at Templecombe, nearly an hour ahead. The occupants of the carriage were a small girl and a smaller girl and a small boy. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. This is the best one he ever wrote. Oh, my God. I forgot by the title, but this is his best story. God, I attribute it to other people, too. I was thinking someone else had written this. This is the best story that he ever wrote. All right, The Storyteller. It was a hot afternoon, and the railway carriage was correspondingly sultry, and the next stop was at Templecombe, nearly an hour ahead. The occupants of the carriage were a small girl, and a smaller girl, and a small boy. An aunt belonging to the children occupied one corner seat, and the further corner seat on the opposite side was occupied by a bachelor, who was a stranger to their party, but the small girls and the small boy emphatically occupied the compartment. Both the aunt and the children were conversational in a limited, persistent way, reminding one of the attentions of a housefly that refused to be discouraged. Most of the aunt's remarks seemed to begin with, "Don't," and nearly all of the children's remarks began with, "Why?" The bachelor said nothing out loud. "Don't, Cyril, don't," exclaimed the aunt as the small boy began smacking the cushions of the seat, producing a cloud of dust at each blow. "Come and look out of the window," she added. The child moved reluctantly to the window. "Why are those sheep being driven out of that field?" he asked. "I expect they are being driven to another field where there is more grass," said the aunt weakly. "But there is lots of grass in that field," protested the boy. "There is nothing else there but grass. Aunt, there is lots of grass in that field." "Perhaps the grass in the other field is better," suggested the aunt fatuously. "Why is it better?" came the swift, inevitable question. "Oh, look at those cows," exclaimed the aunt. Nearly every field along the line had contained cows or bullocks, but she spoke as though she were drawing attention to a rarity. "Why is the grass in the other field better?" persisted Cyril. The frown on the bachelor's face was deepening to a scowl. He was a hard, unsympathetic man, the aunt decided in her mind. She was utterly unable to come to any satisfactory decision about the grass in the other field. The smaller girl created a diversion by beginning to recite "On the Road to Mandalay." She knew only the first line, but she put her limited knowledge to the fullest possible use. She repeated the line over and over in a dreamy but resolute and very audible voice. It seemed to the bachelor as though someone had had a bet with her that she could not repeat the line aloud 2,000 times without stopping. Whoever it was who had made the wager was likely to lose his bet. "Come over here and listen to a story," said the aunt, when the bachelor had looked twice at her and once at the communication cord. The children moved listlessly toward the aunt's end of the carriage. Evidently, her reputation as a storyteller did not rank high in their estimation. in a low, confidential voice, interrupted at frequent intervals by loud, petulant questions from her listeners, she began an unenterprising and deplorably uninteresting story about a little girl who was good and made friends with everyone on account of her goodness and was finally saved from a mad bull by a number of rescuers who admired her moral character. "Wouldn't they have saved her if she hadn't been good?" demanded the bigger of the small girls. It was exactly the question that the bachelor had wanted to ask. "Well, yes," admitted the aunt lamely, "but I don't think they would have run quite so fast to help her if they had not liked her so much." "That's the stupidest story I've ever heard," said the bigger of the small girls with immense conviction. "I didn't listen after the first bit, it was so stupid," said Cyril. The smaller girl made no actual comment on the story, but she had long ago recommenced a murmured repetition of her favorite line. "You don't seem to be a success as a storyteller," said the bachelor, suddenly from his corner. The aunt bristled in instant defense at this unexpected attack. "It's very difficult to tell stories that children can both understand and appreciate," she said stiffly. "I don't agree with you," said the bachelor. "Perhaps you would like to tell them a story," was the aunt's retort. "Tell us a story," demanded the bigger of the small girls. "Once upon a time," began the bachelor, "there was a little girl called Bertha, who was extraordinarily good." The children's momentarily aroused interest began at once to flicker. All stories seem so dreadfully alike, no matter who told them. She did all that she was told. She was always truthful. She kept her clothes clean. She ate milk puddings as though they were jam tarts, learned her lessons perfectly, and was polite in her manners. "Was she pretty?" asked the bigger of the small girls. "Not as pretty as any of you," said the bachelor, "but she was horribly good." There was a wave of reaction in favor of this story. The word horrible, in connection with goodness, was a novelty that commended itself. It seemed to introduce a ring of truth that was absent from the aunt's tales of infant life. "She was so good," continued the bachelor, "that she won several medals for goodness, which she always wore, pinned on her dress. There was a medal for obedience, another medal for punctuality, and a third medal for good behavior. They were large metal medals, and they clicked against one another as she walked. No other child in the town where she lived had as many as three medals, so everybody knew that she must be an extra good child." "Horribly good," quoted Cyril. Everybody talked about her goodness. And the prince of the country got to hear about it, and he said that as she was so very good, she might be allowed once a week to walk in his park, which was just outside of town. It was a beautiful park, and no children were ever allowed in it, so it was a great honor for Bertha to be allowed to go in there. "Were there any sheep in the park?" demanded Cyril. "No," said the bachelor. "There were no sheep." "Why weren't there any sheep?" came the inevitable question arising out of that answer. The aunt permitted herself a smile, which might almost have been described as a grin. "There were no sheep in this..." Well, maybe I'll leave my interpretation out. He's showing the difference between men and women, essentially. "Why weren't there any sheep?" "There were no sheep in the park," said the bachelor, "because the prince's mother had once had a dream that her son would either be killed by a sheep or else by a clock falling on him. For that reason, the prince never kept a sheep in his park or a clock in his palace." The aunt suppressed a gasp of admiration. See, even if you have high IQ in women, you generally don't have the imagination you have in men. Maybe that's me saying that, but that's pretty much how it is. "Was the prince killed by a sheep or by a clock?" asked Cyril. "He's still alive, so we can't tell whether the dream will come true," the bachelor said unconcernedly. "Anyway, there were no sheep in the park, but there were lots of little pigs running all over the place." "What color were they?" "Black, with white faces, white, with black spots, black all over, gray with white patches, and some were white all over." The storyteller paused to let a full idea of the park's treasures sink into the children's imaginations. Then he resumed. "Bertha was rather sorry to find that there were no flowers in the park. She had promised her aunts, with tears in her eyes, that she would not pick any of the kind prince's flowers, and she had meant to keep her promise. So, of course, it made her feel silly to find that there were no flowers to pick." "Why weren't there any flowers?" "Because the pigs had eaten them all," said the bachelor promptly. The gardeners had told the prince that you couldn't have pigs and flowers, so we decided to have pigs and no flowers. There was a murmur of approval at the excellence of the prince's decision. So many people would have decided the other way. Best lines he ever wrote. There were lots of other delightful things in the park. There were ponds with gold and blue and green fish in them, and trees with beautiful parrots that said clever things at a moment's notice, and hummingbirds that hummed all the popular tunes of the day. Bertha walked up and down and enjoyed herself immensely and thought to herself, "If I were not so extraordinarily good, I should not have been allowed to come into this beautiful park and enjoy all that there is to be seen in it." And her three medals clicked against one another as she walked and helped to remind her how very good she really was. Just then, an enormous wolf came prowling into the park to see if it could catch a fat little pig for its supper. "What color was it?" asked the children, amid an immediate quickening of interest. "Mud color all over, with a black tongue and pale gray eyes that gleamed with unspeakable ferocity." The first thing that it saw in the park was Bertha. Her pinafore was so spotlessly white and clean that it could be seen from a great distance. Bertha saw the wolf and saw that it was stealing towards her, and she began to wish that she had never been allowed to come into the park. She ran as hard as she could, and the wolf came after her with huge leaps and bounds. She managed to reach a shrubbery of myrtle bushes, and she hid herself in one of the thickest of the bushes. The wolf came sniff among the branches, its black tongue lolling out of its mouth and its pale gray eyes glaring with rage. Bertha was terribly frightened, and she thought to herself, "If I had not been so extraordinarily good, I should have been safe in town at this moment." However, the scent of the myrtle was so strong that the wolf could not sniff out where Bertha was hiding, and the bushes were so thick that he might have hunted about in them for a long time without catching sight of her, so he thought he might as well go off and catch a little pig instead. Bertha was trembling very much at having the wolf prowling and sniffing so near her, and as she trembled, the medal for obedience clinked against the medals for good conduct and punctuality. The wolf was just moving away when he heard the sound of the medals clinking and stopped to listen. They clinked again in a bush quite near him. He dashed into the bush, his pale gray eyes gleaming with ferocity and triumph, and dragged Bertha out and devoured her to the last morsel. All that was left of her were her shoes, bits of clothing, and the three medals for goodness. Were any of the little pigs killed? No, they all escaped. The story began badly, said the smaller of the small girls, but it had a beautiful ending. It is the most beautiful story that I ever heard, said the bigger of the small girls with immense decision. It is the only beautiful story that I have ever heard, said Cyril. A dissentient opinion came from the aunt. A most improper story to tell young children. You have undermined the effect of years of careful teaching. At any rate, said the bachelor, collecting his belongings preparatory to leaving the carriage, I kept them quiet for 10 minutes, which was more than you were able to do. Unhappy woman, he observed to himself as he walked down the platform of Templecombe Station. For the next 6 months or so, those children will assail her in public with demands for an improper story. And that, I don't care what anyone else thinks. I say that's one of the glories of English literature. In a mere 3-4 pages, that, in my opinion, is the best story he ever wrote. And I'll just... perfect. It captures a lot of his themes and the flipping of things and the comparing and contrasting and juxtaposition of things. Men and women and just attitudes more generally. They may be sex-linked, but they're not. It's not 100%. There are certainly men who are the way the women are and vice versa. But you just truly a wonderful story. And I had totally forgotten that the name of that story was The Storyteller, which seems like it ought to be memorable. Bachelor telling a story on a train to three young kids that their aunt can't keep quiet because children don't want to hear stories about moral goodness. They want to hear exciting stories. Anyway, fantastic stuff from Hector Hugh Munro, The Complete Stories of Saki. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon for more from Saki.